Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Steve Alpert, the painter whose painting The Legacy is the source of a play called The Steadfast. If you were listening last week, you heard my interview with Wes Grantham, who is the director of The Steadfast. Today, you can hear from the painter and hear the story of how it went from an idea to a painting, to a play, and perhaps more. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. Finding wisdom's other words, oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being, becoming, discovering, recovering who you really are. And if you've heard the show before, you know it's because I believe, based on my somehow 30 years of private practice as a psychotherapist, and also my observation of myself and the people I know, that we find ways to hide aspects of ourselves. We do it very young, we do it very thoroughly, we do it so well that even we don't know who we really are. And so we are demonstrating, presenting only, in some cases, a very small portion of who we are. In other cases, we're only hiding a small portion and we're demonstrating a large amount of us, but still not the whole story. I like to call the way we present ourselves, which is not the entire story, our cover story. Like a spy has a cover story. I talk about this in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. I'm not going to have enough time to talk about this much today because I'm playing an interview with Steve Alpert, which, if you were listening to the lead-in to the show, you know is the story of his creativity and how it, in the last few years, turned itself into a painting called The Legacy. And that then turned itself, or is in the process of turning itself, into a stage play. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because, as I have said dozens of times, when a person has the courage to make a living or a life with an art, it is because they have no choice. It is because it is who they really are. And it is my hope that in listening to people talk about that, you will hear what it feels like to be who you really are. And hopefully, if there's a part of you that you've been in denial for, you'll get a glimpse of it. So I will talk more about this in future shows. I have talked about it in past shows. But as I said, I'm going to turn over the mic to my interview with Steve, which is very long because there were many arts in Steve's life before he began to identify himself primarily as a painter and before the creation of The Legacy. And so you hear in Steve's story the emergence from a very young age of a man who always seemed to know what was essential to him. And fortunately for Steve, lots of ways of being in the world are essential to him, and he has had the opportunity and the courage to attempt. That sounds like all of them. Maybe there's still more. Steve is young, and maybe there's still more. Anyway, I don't want to talk any more about this because you will hear the story from his own lips. And so here is my interview with Steve Albert. Okay, so I'm here with Steve Albert in the conservatory green room at the Oslo. And Steve is the instigator of the play which is going to have a reading tonight called The Steadfast, correct?
Yes.
So I interview people who make their living or their life within art. And I have reason to believe that this is true of you.
Yes, that is very true. And I'm, I guess, kind of a bohemian at heart. My mother was an artist and my father was an entrepreneur. So it's sort of a diabolical combination that was set upon me.
Well, actually, you're leading me right to where the question I always ask. How did you, whatever art you've been dedicating your life to, how did it get started? How did it find you? I mean the very beginning.
That's a very incisive question. I guess it just sort of found me. I was not involved in the arts. Well, I was involved in music when I was in grade school and elementary school. And
does that mean you took piano lessons?
I took piano lessons. I played in the band orchestra, and I played French horn. I played baritone horn. I was forced to take. My mother said to me, "Well, in third grade, she said to me, well, you have a choice now. It's either going to be bar mitzvah lessons or piano lessons."
So, you're kidding.
So which one? I said, "I'm definitely not doing bar mitzvah lessons." So I said, I'll go for the piano. We had piano at home. My father was an audiophile in the 50s, and we had big stereo, and I grew up in a house filled with music, jazz and classical, mostly jazz. Mostly.
Okay, so neither one of them played?
No, my father fashioned himself as a piano player. He was a terrible piano player. He played by ear, and he didn't have a very good ear, but he had very fine taste, what I thought to be, in the music that he played. Records that we listened to, and he was in the music business for a while as an entrepreneur. He had a record company for a time, and my mother was a singer.
Oh,
but she was not a professional singer. But
no,
she,
but there
she,
was a love.
She sang, and my mother was a painter.
Oh,
so I was surrounded by music and art as a kid.
Yes,
and also they also had a terrible marriage, so that's also great for an artist as well.
In what way?
Well, because it forces you to find your way.
Say something about that. I mean,
it wasn't comfortable.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
It was a very uncomfortable place to be, and I had and being an only child as well, I was forced on a lot of rainy days and other days to spend a lot of time on my own. And of course, the TV was the greatest and the newest thing, and so, TV held my fascination. It was my, in many ways, TV was my caregiver. Yeah. I spent a lot of time watching TV, and, you know, it was stimulating for my mind.
So, do you remember early on any impulse to make music or make art?
No. Well, you know, the funny thing about music was that I loved playing. I was good enough to be able to play in a band or an orchestra. I could learn the notes. Actually, I could copy other players I was sitting next to, and I had a good enough ear. But, you know, I really was not the kind of musician that could invent music. Mm-hmm. And eventually that, I left it because I saw that there were other kids who were really gifted, and they could improvise. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't have that. I had an appreciation for it, and I understand how the drug of music and how musicians, I don't think I've ever experienced such euphoria as in those early parts of my life, being in the music. I remember in my mind thinking I'm in the music and playing in a band or playing in an orchestra. It was nothing more intoxicating than that. If I had another life, I had two other lives, would be two other things that I would do, and one life would be as a musician.
Yeah.
But in this life, I just did not have that music-making thing inside of me.
Right.
So I knew that. So I left that for the 100-yard dash.
Oh, for something physical.
I was always a jock, because my parents were it was not a happy time at home, so I had to find ways to get the hell out of the house. And I had tremendous energy, you know, and I was a decent athlete, and I was always, you know, it's funny, little boys always know who's the strongest, who's the most coordinated, who can throw a ball the furthest, and who's the fastest. And I was just the fastest. Since I can remember, I could get across a field or any amount of territory under 200 yards faster than any other of the boys.
Ooh, a wonderful skill.
So that was my thing.
Yeah.
So when I could be on the track team freshman year, I went to the band. I went to the band leader. I was had band or orchestra every other day, and then stage band. We had marching band. So I was in the music, you know. And I said, you know, I really want to join the track team. Can I just drop out of the orchestra and just play in the band? And he said, no, you have to make a choice. And I remember in ninth grade or in eighth grade, maybe eighth. I don't remember. So I remember this is so unfair that I have to choose between these two things.
Yes.
But
it was.
But he was very steadfast in holding his ground and saying, no, you can't. You have to make a choice.
This is the second choice. I mean, first your mother says bar mitzvah or music.
That was an easy choice.
Yeah.
That was not difficult.
But again, it's interesting because
well, you have crossroads in life.
Well, but not like that. Most people don't have the, this is it. You get to choose right here. Well, okay, so, but you did.
I did.
And so you said, well...
So I said, I got angry with him.
Yeah.
And, I said, well, see ya.
God, what did he say? Do you remember?
Good question. What did he say? He was unmoved.
Wow.
I mean, he only had two French horn players.
And you were one of them.
And I was one of them. Not too many people could play that thing. That was a hard thing to play. And I was one of the steadfast baritone horn players in the band. So, you know, he was losing one of his utility brass players. I don't think I was that great that he really cared, but he just, you know, he'd been doing this a long time. So this was his way of doing it, and I was just another kid in the band.
Wow.
So I said, see ya. And I went into, varsity jockland for all of high school.
It's interesting because if he hadn't done that, who knows, right?
Who knows? I don't know. I don't think I want to stay with music. I was really not that good.
No, I can hear that
it was not something that it was going to take me anywhere.
Right. And it was...
It was a great escape. It was really a great way to spend time. I love being in the music, and I love music. I still do. And I guess I became a creative jock for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was my identity in high mm-hmm. school. Every I guess, boy and girl needs an identity in high school. High school is such a difficult passage. And my parents... marriage had already come apart.
Oh, when did, how old were you?
I was 12.
Well, okay, so at 12, your parents divorced.
Right.
And right around then, or a little bit later, you became a jock.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And you do this through high school, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and I had a little scholarship to college, but I didn't have to.
A track scholarship?
It was sort of a weird, it was kind of a grant in aid. It was an inducement to come.
Mm-hmm.
And
where'd you go?
Ithaca College.
Oh.
And once I got there, I realized that I wasn't going to make much of a living as a running the 100-yard dash. And I got very involved in television production.
Oh.
Communication school.
Mm-hmm.
So that got my, that really, I remember I walked into the studio the very first day of orientation, and I looked around and I said, this is it for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It was a calling.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of a world of a career of creativity. And I became a film editor.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in TV news for 5 years as a film editor at local news and on CBS in New York, and then I went to NBC as a producer, and a field producer and a writer. And then after 5 years of local news, I was ready to move on. That was not going to be a career I wanted to stay in. It was brutal. It was it's a burnout thing.
Oh, yes. Are you talking about the...
I'm talking about the news business.
Yeah. No. Are you talking about, you know, how much time and energy, or are you talking about all politics and...
All of it.
All
consuming, and I thought, you know, this is not for me.
You know, it's so interesting about you is that you seem to have had a lot of interests that are somewhat diverse and a lot of energy and a lot of passion, and you seem to know pretty clearly, you seem to have a kind of true north about
this is good,
right. This is not good.
Right. It was never about money either.
No, clearly it wasn't, although there was this thing about whether I could make a living out of this or I could make a life out of this.
Yeah.
But much more about, does this fit me? Does this capture me?
Right. I think that was important because of my childhood.
Yes, you learned very early that you had to do that for yourself.
Absolutely.
It wasn't coming from anybody else.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was 30 years in that business.
Wow.
And I went from news to documentary, made a lot of documentaries.
Hmm.
And
you wrote.
I wrote, yeah. I don't consider myself a writer per se, although I just finished a book, so I guess I'm a writer. But
you have to be careful about that.
Why?
Because it's like being a little bit pregnant. If you write, you're a writer.
I guess so, but I do so many other things. I don't consider myself. That's my main.
Yeah, but that's...
I can't even tell you what my main thing is now.
No, clearly you cannot. But one of the things you are is a writer.
Yes.
That's okay.
Oh, yeah,
you
so
can
absolutely.
Have it.
Oh, no, I accept that.
Okay. We've got 30 years.
Yeah.
And one day you said, okay, enough of this?
I did a lot of industrial videos.
Mm-hmm.
In around the 1980s, corporate America discovered the VCR. And they realized that they could communicate to their employees with this new technology. And when I came out of college with a degree in communications, a minor in painting, throw that in, because I... Yeah, that's another story. But
I want that story because we're going to come to that, aren't
we? Okay. Yes, we are. We are. But we should finish this.
Yeah. Okay. Fine.
Where was I?
Corporate America.
Okay. Corporate America discovered the VCR, and all of a sudden there was a whole industry of the world was filled with not that many, but there was enough of us, meaning producers, directors, people, filmmakers, who came out of school in the early 70s. I graduated in 73. And there was opportunity to make videos for corporations, left and right. So I had a dalliance at that time. I'd always wanted to be a movie director.
Uh-huh.
And I went to California for 10 days to see what that was like. And that was enough of that. I said, this is clearly not for me. I realized that finally that what I was more than anything was an entrepreneur, and that I had to work for myself, and that was more important than anything else. I worked in corporate video, and I could find that I was could be successful going out to pitch clients and come up with ideas, write them up as a writer,
mm-hmm.
and then execute them as a producer, director, sometimes.
Ironically, this new career, which required all of these skills, you already had.
Yes.
It's great.
Yeah. There was a legion of us at that time. There was a bunch of us who were similar in
mm-hmm.
that fashion. And I remember I linked up with the phone company in New York at that time, which is New York Telephone, and they became a client for about 20 years. I made a lot of videos for them. I produced 16 training videos in 9 months, 10 months' time, and I was exhausted. And I said, I can't do this anymore. I didn't marry early. I remember an old-time film editor said to me, don't get married until you get get established in the business. And he said, because then you're going to have to take a job that, you're going to be stuck in. You're going to make your life miserable. So I married a wonderful woman when I was 42. And that changed my life. Dorothy totally changed my life. And in the 1998 or 99, when I said to her, I know, I really can't do this anymore. I don't know what I'm going to do. She said, well, why don't you go for the painting? Well, I've been painting all this time, you know, as a hobby. I was always, I made watercolors for 20 years. When I would travel, I would take watercolors. I'd make many trips by myself, just take my paints. It was a trip just to spend time alone and to paint. Mm-hmm. So I guess it finally caught up to me. She said, why don't you go for the painting? And, you know, Lynn, it was something I wanted to do so badly in my life, but I never thought was possible, because my mother was a very, very talented artist. She was classically trained. She could render you sitting here. She was fantastic. And I didn't have that skill. I couldn't draw, really. I still can't draw that well. And I said, well, my mother couldn't rub two nickels together as an artist. She became an interior decorator. So Dorothy said, why don't you go for the painting? I'll make the money for a year. And I said, okay. So I spent most of the winter, I set up in the kitchen and made a lot of paintings, and I sold most of them that summer in outdoor street fairs. And I said, well, maybe I can...
Yet in business again for himself. Right?
Exactly. So...
You know, it's, forgive me, and you can tell me if I'm wrong in any way, this is none of my business, but this all seems to me to refer back to that early childhood experience of, I'm on my own here.
Oh, totally.
And I have to make it work.
Absolutely.
You know, right?
People always say to me, oh, you know, it's so wonderful that you've done this. And I always say to them, I didn't have a choice.
Yeah, right.
I said, no, this is not a wonderful thing. This is just what I have to do.
Well, let me...
It is a wonderful thing.
It's a wonderful thing.
It's a wonderful thing. But, yeah. You know, it's just...
Because not everybody would have taken that experience and done this with it.
Well, right.
You know? So you discovered that you could actually make money with the painting. And I'm wondering something else. Your description of what it was like to be in the music, I'm assuming that you have a similar in the painting, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
With music going. It used to be jazz. Now it's classical. In fact, the legacy painting, which the play is based on, was all Philip Glass. I choose the music based on what I'm going to paint.
Wow.
Yeah, when when I started making these military paintings, that's a whole other...
Yeah, well, let's go there.
All right, okay.
So what began that?
It started with a visit to the Vietnam Memorial, just in Washington with a friend, and we were walking along the mall. I said, what's that black thing down there on the right? But I didn't really, you know, I had a high draft number, high lottery number, and it was a really, really twisted time in our history. And to me, what I remember is that, you know, when Peter Fonda in Easy Rider took the American flag and put it upside down on his jacket, to me that symbolized what was going on in this country at that time. And of course, we had our parents who were World War II veterans.
Yep.
They were not about that. You know, when your country calls you, you go. Of course, our opinion was that it was different. World War II and that era with Japan and Germany, I would have been the first one in the office. In the 101st, I would have been whatever. So that was a different time. But our parents did not make the generation gap, the generation above us who had served and been through World War II and faced the end of the United States possibly, fighting for our existence. They were not about putting the flag upside down. So when I went to the Vietnam Memorial Wall, I had a meltdown. It was very powerful, and I thought that my name should be up there, and I felt terrible.
You mean because you didn't
fight?
Right.
Because I didn't serve. This was like opening up something that I didn't even know existed.
A part of you that you didn't know.
Right. Demonstrated against the war.
In my experience, most people, and this is a gross generalization, either have a kind of through line, I'm this kind of person. They manage to be in denial for anything else that doesn't fit with that through line. There's a quote, my favorite quote from, I think it's Walt Whitman. Do I contradict myself? Well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what human beings are, but yeah. Most of us aren't able.
Well, you're not taught that.
No, you're taught that, right. This is right, this is wrong, you right. be this, that right.
right.
And then people are either that or they rebel against it.
Right.
But they don't
they
allow
don't integrate
for
all
that.
The, all the different
things. That's right.
Yeah.
But given the unfortunate experience of your early childhood, you really do seem to be somebody who is aware of the multitude and who has been able to allow that to become conscious, for you to embrace it. I mean, we have, you know, we have a musician, and we have a jock, and then we have a, you know, a businessman, and then we have a painter, and now we have, you know, and now we talk, we hear about the interest in yearning towards the military, which doesn't fit with any of what went before, except possibly the jock. It's just an, I mean, it's an unusual, you know, and because it's unusual to some extent, it has to be slightly uncomfortable. It must be, I mean, people it must be hard for people to categorize you.
I'm sure.
Do you know?
I don't know what the hell they think of me. I have a lot of friends.
I'm sure you do, and I'll bet they're all over the spectrum.
Yeah, they are.
Mm-hmm.
They are. And a friend of mine said to me last night, she said, you missed your calling. I said, what do you mean? She said, yeah, she said, you should have been a commander of troops in the military. I said,
wow.
I said, I know. I said, but it's too late now.
But it's not too late for what you're doing.
No.
Right.
No, my mission is very, very clear now. But let's talk about how I got there.
Yeah, please.
So I had this experience at the Vietnam Memorial Wall. Somehow I dragged my ass out of there. And hot, exhausted, I'd been sobbing, it was a mess, and then I buried it.
Yeah, too painful.
Because I didn't know what to do with it.
Right.
Like, what can I, you know, survivor's guilt, all that stuff, I didn't really know what that was until many years later. I made a documentary on three Holocaust survivors, and that was, taught me about survivor's guilt. They all talked about that. So, went along my merry way in my life, and then September 11th happened. My wife and I live about 5 miles from Ground Zero.
Oh my.
And that thing shook me as a defining moment in our generation. So a defining moment in my life. I didn't feel safe in my hometown anymore. I was angry. I wanted to sign up. I was too old. But I would not believe my wife and my family. You know, it was clearly ridiculous, irrational thought. Were I 22, I would have signed up right there. And a lot of kids did. Said that we were going to war. So, I think a lot of artists were trying to process what that meant for them in that day, especially those of us in New York. And then I remember in 2003, I opened up the New York Times, and there was a piece about that we had lost to Black Hawk helicopters and 17 people. A little image, an oblong image in the Times with a tiny little Black Hawk silhouette in this big airspace. And it captivated my interest, and I read the article, and it touched me deeply. About 2 years before, I had been, it was a retrospective of my great mentor and hero, Gerhard Richter, German painter. There was one room with large paintings of military aircraft. I remember the aircraft that he painted. They were gorgeous, and they were menacing, and they were powerful. And I said, I'm going to make an image of a Black Hawk helicopter. What am I going to do with it? I don't know. I'm going to make a big one. I'm going to make it 42 by 60. What do I do with it? I don't know. So the first thing I did was make a little study, a little 9 by 12. And I called a buddy of mine when it was still wet. And he came over, and he looked at it, and he said, wow. He said, you know, I have a godson who's graduating business school. He was a Black Hawk pilot in Afghanistan. I'm going to buy this for him. So he gave me a couple $100, and as he drove away, I thought to myself, how is this possible? I finished this first little Black Hawk helicopter, and it's going to an actual Black Hawk pilot. It was like throwing gasoline on the fire. It was unbelievable. I said, this is a message from I don't know where, but I'm going to continue. So I made this image of this big helicopter, and I showed it to my friends. I didn't know what to do with it. I made four or five more, large and small. Went on eBay, and this thing popped up. And it said, for $39.95, just give us your credit card number, and we'll send a care package to a GI in Iraq. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And about 6 weeks later, I get an envelope with a thank you note. In the package were two CDs. One said non-copyright, one said copywritten. So I didn't look at the copywritten, I looked at the non-copywritten. And there were probably about, 300, 400 images of photos taken by American GIs in Iraq. Front lines, behind the lines, people in the street, everything. And there were some images that were just very, very powerful. I whittled them down to 20, and then down to 10, and I made 5 of them. And now I had these helicopters, and I had these images that I had made, these battle combat images. 2004, at Dover Air Force Base, which is the National Mortuary. It was a woman photographer who took maybe 300 images of these flag-draped transfer cases. We call them coffins, but they military equipment called transfer cases. And she took photographs of these, and a very left-leaning website requested to upload the images. And somebody at the Pentagon said, okay, and they got them. And then someone else, there was a whole big brouhaha,
and they shut those things down,
and there was a piece in the Times, and I went to memoryhole.org, which no longer exists, and there were all the photographs. And I said, wait a minute, are we back in the 60s again?
Oh, yeah.
We got kids coming home who've given their lives.
But we can't show them.
We don't get to honor them, and they don't get to be honored.
Right.
I said, that's not right. And it really angered me.
I remember this well.
I said, I'm going to make a very large painting. And there was one image that really grabbed me. It was a telephoto image of 8 Air Force Honor Guard members, full dress, white gloves, carrying a flag-draped transfer case across the tarmac. And I made that painting, another 42 by 60. A big piece, big strong piece. Wound up giving it away and happily donating it. It wound up at the Dover Air Force Base Museum. There's more about this painting, which we don't need to get into for this time. But it was a long year when that painting finally found a home. My wife and I drove down to Dover. We had a little handover ceremony. And we were surrounded by these Honor Guard people. They were wonderful. And then one of the Honor Guard women looked at the painting. It was a big black man in the lead left. And she said, oh, that's Sergeant Willis. He's still here. She gets on her cell phone, and 5 minutes later, in walks, like he walked out of the thing, with Sergeant Willis, and standing in front of me like this, I could not speak.
I'll bet.
I could not speak.
I'll bet he
has. I couldn't even tell this story without choking up, but now I can.
Yeah, good.
I've told it enough.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most astounding moments of my life.
And his, I'm sure.
I don't know, but I don't know what he was thinking. I just was so consumed with, like, oh my God, I painted this guy a year ago, and here he is standing in front of me. It never occurred to me that was possible. And he said, you know, you got to come with me. I'm going to call some of my buddies. So they got me into a room, a little room like this, surrounded by 25 of these guys. And they said, okay, so tell us the story of the painting.
Oh, my God.
And I did. And it was wonderful. I actually returned there 2 years later. I had made prints of the painting to give to the current members of the Honor Guard. And 11 of them showed up. Now, 11 people show up in shining uniforms. It looks like 100.
Yeah.
And they all came up and they wanted me to personalize it.
I'm sure they did.
And one little girl, young woman, said to me in her uniform, she said, no one's ever thanked me for my service.
Oh, God.
Another guy said to me, you know, he says, I'm going to remember this the rest of my life.
I'm sure.
So now you understand.
I do. I absolutely do.
So, after that experience at Dover, my wife and I were astounded by how wonderful these young kids were. To us, they were kids. They were young men and women, responsible, who were, you know,
laying their life on the line.
Yep. Not too long after that, I visited Walter Reed Hospital.
Oh, wait.
And I heard on the radio that you could go and thank veterans. going to have to do this. So I called for an appointment, and a buddy of mine in New York, we got on Amtrak and met another friend of mine in Washington whose son had served two tours in Afghanistan and come back. And we were met by a short army captain, a woman, very stout, very serious, but very pleasant. And she said, I'm going to take you through the neurology unit today.
Oi.
So I said to myself, what are you asking for?
Yeah, really?
You're going to get it.
All right.
You're going to get it. And the first room that we walked in, hospital room, raised bed, big kid, blonde hair, well, I don't know, light colored, but he was, his head looked like a baseball with the stitches and the staples. And he'd been in a an IED explosion.
Yeah.
He was not good. And his father was there. We walked in the room, I looked at him, I was like, all the air went out of my lungs. I had to force myself. I said, you know what? If that kid can be there like that, then I can be in here. I had to talk to myself. And I forced myself. I said, okay, now you have to take a breath. And we talked to him. He was lovely. We talked to his dad, and we thanked him for service. We bought him little trinkets. My friend bought him Starbucks cards and movie passes because he had heard from his son, who had heard from someone else, that you should give this kind of thing because it gives them an inducement to get out. On the way out, we learned about an organization called Fisher House. Fisher House is a nonprofit that builds, like Ronald McDonald houses, on VA hospital grounds. There's 40-something of them now. And parents who are visiting their wounded kids can stay there for up to a month for free, which is a big deal for military families.
No kidding.
And I started painting these images of the from the CDs. And I called the VP of Communications.
So, at Fisher House.
Yeah, and long story short, we sold 8 of the paintings. We raised about 27 grand, every penny going to Fisher House. And I went to the dinner that night. I was signing posters for an hour and a half. There was a long line of people lining up. People whose family members were in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I personalized these Black Hawk, from the original Black Hawk painting.
Right.
I made posters of them. And I signed these posters and gave them to them. And from there, I was introduced to Dan Scruggs, who created the Vietnam Memorial Wall. And he was raising money for he's creating a museum across from the wall. And the museum is dedicated to citizenship and service throughout the history of our country. So Scruggs said he wanted me to make a painting for the museum. So Bill set up a lunch. And going to this lunch, I knew that this was not...
This was big time.
Yeah.
Right.
And this was not a little pond in the water.
No.
This was something...
Significant.
Yeah, significant. And it was. And he said, you know, how'd you like to make a painting that will be seen by the president and the vice president will unveil it? We have the 25th anniversary of the wall coming up on Veterans Day, November 11th, and we can unveil the painting there. He said, well, what are you thinking about? I said, I'd be honored to make a painting for you. I said, I'm thinking about something 40 by 78, which is about as large as I can get in and out of my studio. It's a small studio. 40 inches by 78 inches. He goes, okay, well, what do you see? I said, well, I see foot soldiers crossing a field. I don't know where that came from, but that's what I saw in my head. And he goes, without hesitation, he says, okay. He snapped his fingers and said, okay. But make it the 8 uniform eras of the United States Army. So I said, that's an extraordinary idea. He says, okay, so it's Continental Army, 1812, Civil War, Union, Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Vietnam. So, but Korea.
Korea?
So, well, Koreans were wearing the uniforms from World War II.
Ah.
Anyway, so I said, okay, when do you want the painting? He says, how about end of September? I shook hands with him, and then I was off. And I'm on the street.
Flying, right?
I was not on the ground.
What
just happened here? What is this painting? So I ordered a very expensive and big canvas, linen, mm-hmm. museum quality. It came about a month later. I said, okay. Now, every painting I make has a sky, and the sky is the determining factor for the painting. That's just how it has turned out for me. And I said, what's the sky? I don't know. I said, I got to start looking at skies. And the painting came, this big white thing sitting in my studio, half the size of that wall, looking at me, and I'm a small studio, and I was like, shit. I didn't have the sky. My first thought was, like, the sky should be an American flag. But I said, no, they already did that with the opening scene in the movie Patton. And I said, I don't want a graphic flag as a sky. So I didn't know what to do. And I, for 4, 5, 6 weeks, as time was going away, I can't start until I figure out what the sky is. Finally, I say to my friend Randy Greiner, who's my partner's wife, and I said, what do you think I should do for the sky? I said, I'm stuck. She goes, it should be the American flag. I said, okay. She's right. I was right at the beginning. But it can't be a graphic. It has to be a sky that is evocative of the flag, the Stars and Stripes. So that's what it became. I worked for a solid week with Philip Glass, probably 30 layers of paint, and I pulled off the sky. And I knew that. Then came the hard work, which is the figures.
Right.
So I took photographs of all my buddies. I had them come over, shot them on my deck. And my wife was standing in front of me, and she says, the present day soldier is going to be a woman, right? I said, no. And then she got, I could tell, she got,
yeah.
She said, no, it has to be, and I said, and I heard Jan's voice, I tried, and then I realized that she was right. I said, okay, if you would walk outside, I'd appreciate that. So I shot her figure, and her figure is the present-day soldier. I had to beef it up because she's so thin. Anyway, long story short, I made the painting.
Right.
And it had to turn out, I knew in the beginning that it had to be not good. And great was not good. It had to be something extraordinary. The word is exceptional.
Yeah.
It had to be something exceptional. I finished it. And here's the other part that's crazy. I said, what day is it? As I'm signing it. It was September 11th, 2007.
Oh my God.
That's the date on the painting.
Jesus.
So, finished. I brought it down to Washington. I had a crate built for it. So now I've got about $1,000 invested just in the thing.
Right.
I had to rent a van, and I brought it in, and I didn't know, this is the first time anyone who's not been a friend of mine would see this thing. And I had it covered, draped, and we were in a conference room, and he had about 20 of his employees in the room, and the Jan slid in there at the end. I dropped the thing. I didn't want to see anybody's face. I just kept looking at the floor. And then I heard a gasp. And then a couple of other... I said, okay, I got it. And then Jan proceeded to tell me how he couldn't do anything with it.
What do you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we don't have the money. I said, Jan, we could have a public campaign with this poster.
Right, to raise money.
Right. And you already have retired generals on your board.
Right.
You have Colin Powell, who's the honorary chairman. If we have a press conference and we get USA Today to come and they run an image of this thing, we will sell hundreds and thousands of these posters.
Right.
Didn't go for it.
Because, do you know what?
No, I don't know. So it sat in my storage space for 2.5 years.
Wow.
Eating me alive.
I'll bet.
Until a year ago, November, I was introduced to a gentleman who... also had a very big commitment in his volunteer work to veterans. And he took a shine to this image on his computer. And I'm having lunch with him in his office. And all of a sudden, he's looking down. And I said, Michael, are you okay? And he looks up at me and he says, what if those soldiers could step out of that painting and tell their stories? I said, oh, my God, Michael, that's a huge idea. He says, okay, figure it out. So I left the office. I called Wes, and Wes is a brilliant, he's an extraordinary human being. I said, Wes, I said, I'm going to send you some stuff on the on your email. Check your email, and then call me when you look at the stuff I sent him. And I told him the idea. He says, let's do it. And when Wes says, let's do it, he means it. So I said, well, we need a writer. He says, I've got the perfect writer. Who? Matt Smart. Okay. So let me meet Matt. So we had breakfast with Matt. He told me two compelling things, and I said, you got the job. So I said to my friend Argy, yeah, how the hell am I going to do this? He says, you have a lot of friends. He says, you can call 20 of your friends and ask them for $500. Anyway, long story short, since then I raised about $12,000. my worst nightmare was that the script was going to be terrible.
Yes, and right, and you'd be stuck. Like,
what do we do now?
Right.
You know, all these investors, even though it's $500.
Right.
So I take that seriously.
Yeah.
And, but I kept on saying, you know, my faith is in Wes.
Mm-hmm. And his Wes, faith is in Matt.
Right. And so it's going to be all, it's all going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched this rehearsal mm-hmm. of the first act. And in the first 10 minutes, I'm sitting next to the girl that Wes had asked to be his assistant. And I said to her, is this as good as I think it is? She goes, it's better than that. So it was, the first act anyway, was extraordinary. I said, my God, this kid has knocked it out of the park. All the things we had talked about for months, that it had to be this, it had to be that, it couldn't be this, it couldn't be political, it could not be pro-war, it could not be anti-war, it had to be all about service, all about people who step out of their lives, put on the uniform, and fought, and gave anything they had for something they believed in. I said, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
It's about citizenship and service, and it's the history of our country. And I said, this may be the only thing that all Americans can agree about right now. That's what came to me. And I said, this is what, you know. And you have to be respectful to the Southerners.
Right, I was just going to say, you've got all sides in this.
Right.
Right.
I have worked in many creative projects over the years.
Mm-hmm.
This thing is unlike any of them.
Because?
Doors keep on swinging open. Every project I've ever worked on, I've always felt like I was pushing a peanut up a hill
right.
with my nose.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
but this project has everything this, you are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like your whole life has been leading to this
it's
project.
Converged.
Right, exactly.
It's bizarre.
Right, well, no, it's not.
It is.
It's perfect.
I know it's perfect, but that's bizarre.
Well.
Because I've never...
Unless you don't believe in it.
I totally believe in it with every cell in my body.
I know. It's very, very exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, so now...
So that's the story.
Yes. And I want to say, and
so
I'll
now
say
you see why it's not all about me. Jan had this idea of the eight...
Oh, no, I see.
And then
I
Michael
hear
Spencer
it.
Says to me, what if these soldiers... That was not my idea.
I know. All of these things were coming at you.
Yeah.
But you were the only one who could do them.
Right.
I know.
Yeah.
And I understand that it's not about you.
Right.
I understand that in sort of the words of the prophet, it's coming through you.
Correct.
Do you know what I mean?
I totally.
Yeah, right. And when you know that...
That's when I feel most alive.
Yes.
And most at peace.
Yes. That was what I was trying to say. There is a calm about that.
Totally.
This is what I'm meant to do,
yep.
And I can do it, and I am doing it. And that's all.
And
right?
I have an extraordinary team.
Well, again...
And the painting just sold, the original painting.
Really?
The legacy painting. This is the craziest part. I don't know what's going to happen going forward. But I was speaking to an old college roommate, back in October, and we were catching up. What are you doing? And he says, I told him about the Legacy Project. And he says, I have a guy for you. Who? Joe Grano. Who's Joe Grano? Joe Grano is a decorated Vietnam veteran. He was captain of the Green Berets. Highly decorated, severely wounded, self-rehabilitated, was the... never went to college, became the CEO of Payne Webber, was the first honorary chairman of the Homeland Security Administration.
Oh,
because his
God.
Buddy Tom Ridge called him up and asked him to. And also one of the main financiers of Jersey Boys, because he's an old friend of Frankie Valli's. Because he used to hire Frankie Valli to do parties.
God.
So Frankie Valli came to him when they were doing Jersey Boys, and
right.
they had a big financier who was going to finance the whole thing, but backed out for half. And then he went out to California to see a preview. People stood up at the end,
oh, well,
kind of cheering.
How many times have you seen it?
And Joe has made a bloody fortune just
no
on this show alone.
Right.
It's the only show he's ever been involved in.
Yeah, well, if you were going to pick a show to be involved in.
So on that day that my friend Greg told me, well, I'm making an introduction to Joe for you.
Right.
Because my business partner is a good friend of his. Fine. That night, my young attorney was coming over to see a painting that he wanted to buy for me.
Right.
And at the end of the evening, I said to him, by the way, do you know a guy named Joe Grano? He goes, yes, I represent him.
I love these stories.
So we sent an email. He said, send me an email. Write what you want. I'll pass it on. within 24 hours of Joe getting the email, he says, I'd like to talk to you. Let's have an appointment. I sit down with Joe Grano. He says, you know, I don't know anything about you or who you are, so talk to me. So I did about 15 minutes, 15 of my best minutes, and told him the story. He'd seen the painting. I sent him the image. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know what? I really like what you're doing. I'll give you X amount of dollars, and I'll buy that painting. And then when we sell posters at the during the run of the show, I'll make my money back, and then we'll split 50-50. So I call Ken, a good friend of mine, and co-producer of my off-Broadway show. Now he's a big Broadway producer on his own, and he's joined me on this thing. And I told him, and he's not a guy who gets very excited easily, but he got very excited. And he said, yeah, it's like a down payment on his participation in the show. I said, absolutely. So I don't know what this may just be a very complicated way to sell a lot of prints. I don't know. But I think this thing has the potential to last, to run for years.
It has legs,
It has big legs. And the thing about it is how Matt Smart wrote it. It travels from time period to time period effortlessly.
Oh, I can't wait to see it.
We're on the phone on our original, after we made the deal, to talk about, you know, the input. He says, tell me everything you want.
Right.
And he's writing it. I said, okay. I said, I don't know. I said, how are you going to do this? He goes, I don't know, but I want to do it in a way that's never been done before. I said, okay. And for the months, I'm thinking to myself, what the hell is he going to do? What's he going to do? Well, I saw it in Evansville, and I was knocked out. And what's so amazing is that Wes is a master of staging. The two of them work together like one organism.
So this is also meant to be for them. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Right.
They're very close friends.
Well, but I mean, this is what they do.
This is what they do. It keeps on growing.
It just keeps
this
bringing...
This is a boulder in the water.
Exactly. Well, it just keeps bringing in the right people.
Correct.
That's right. It attracts them, right.
Joe said, Joe sitting in his office said, you know, I bleed red, white, and blue. I said, I know you do.
Right.
I said, you're the perfect guy to have this painting.
That's right.
And I said to him, and I also said, you know, I want you to agree that you will donate this painting to a public place or an appropriate place sometime in the rest of your life or in your will.
Right. And he said, of course,
he
right.
said he would do that.
Of course.
He said, but it's my painting. I can do it the way
I want.
I said, absolutely.
This is actually a good place to stop. Thank you very much, Steve.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
So there you have it, and if you are curious, you know that you're getting in on the ground floor of what promises to be a very exciting ride for the Steadfast and Steve Alpert and Wes Grantham and Matt Smart. Again, you heard the interview with Wes last week, and I am hoping to interview Matt when I am there for the reading next week. If you are curious about the painting, please go up on my website, thelinshow.com. I realize that there is another The Lynn Show, even now spelled the way mine is, L-Y-N-N-E. So you do have to do thelinshow.com. And if you find someone from Ypsilanti, that's not me. So if you're curious about the painting, please go up on the website. If you're curious about the others, Steve's other work, you can find it at his website, stevealpertart.com. That's all one word, S-T-E-V-E-A-L-P-E-R-T-A-R-T. If you go up on my website, there you will also find all of the other shows that I've done. You can choose the shows you want to listen to by topic. There's a listing of the kinds of headlines, really, for the shows. You know, if there's an interview with an actor or if I'm talking about cover story, that'll show up in the listing and you can choose the show you want to listen to. Also, you can find out about the book when you can, you will. You can get the book or get the audiobook or the workbook. There's all kinds of stuff on the website, including videos and photographs from some of the past shows that I've done. So, as always, I need to thank the remarkable intrepid Josh Hackney, who knows everything there is to know about all the things I need to know, which have to do with recording, electronics, computer. These are all specialties of Josh, and he is remarkably capable. So if there's anything that you need to know about any of these things, you can go up on my website, click on Email Me, and say, I want Josh, and I will get him for you. And of course, you can click on that Email Me and ask me any questions. You can follow the show on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and on Facebook. And please comment. I'm curious to hear always what you might think of the show, or me, or any of my interviewees. So, as always, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show. Something that you didn't know that you found interesting, something you did know that you forgot, something that instigated something inside of you that you didn't know was there or knew was there but had somehow forgotten. In any case, something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, and you know I hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Thank you.